The Duke of Alastair considered the letter from his solicitor for a third time, though the words had not changed. They were as stark and unyielding as the granite of his ancestral home. Ruin was not a distant storm cloud. It was the damp chill already seeping through the foundations of his life. His father, a man who had confused lavishness with legacy, had left behind a title of immense prestige and debts of an equally immense scale. Alastair, Duke since his 25th year, had spent the last 5 trying to hold back a tide of creditors with the crumbling seawall of his name. It was no longer enough. The solicitor's proposal was laid out in dry, merciless script. An arrangement. A marriage. The daughter of Sir Gideon Ainsworth, a baronet whose title was fresh and whose fortune was anything but. The girl, a Miss Eleanor Ainsworth, came with a dowry so substantial it could not merely patch the holes in his finances but refloat the entire dukedom. It was a lifeline. It was a humiliation. He had met her once, briefly, at some crush in London the previous season. His memory offered a vague impression. Brown hair, quiet posture, a face that was neither plain nor remarkable. She had been utterly and completely unmemorable, a ghost at the feast. His cousin, Lord Vance, had been with him that evening. Vance, whose own finances were a precarious house of cards, thrived on the misfortunes of others. "The Ainsworth girl," Vance had drawled, watching her across the ballroom. "They say her grandfather was in trade, something vulgar, like shipping or textiles. Her dowry is the only interesting thing about her." Alastair had merely grunted in reply, his attention on a far more decorative creature with diamonds in her hair. He had not given Miss Ainsworth another thought. Until now. Now, she was not a person, but a figure in a ledger, the sum that would balance his catastrophic accounts. He dipped his quill in the inkwell. He had to write to Vance to put a stop to the loan his cousin had been arranging, a loan with predatory terms that Alastair now, blessedly, no longer needed to consider. He wrote quickly, his script a slash of black against the cream paper. He described the arrangement in clipped, dispassionate terms, a necessary merger of title and fortune. He felt a flicker of something, shame, perhaps, or just distaste, and added a final, dismissive sentence to justify the transaction to himself, as much as to his cousin. "The Ainsworth girl will do. She is plain and quiet, and understands nothing of business, which is a mercy. The dowry is all that matters. It will plug the holes in the ship, and she can occupy herself with needlepoint while I write the course." He sealed the letter without rereading it. It was a simple statement of fact, a business decision. He felt no particular malice toward the girl. He felt nothing at all. She was a means to an end, a quiet, solvent ghost who would soon haunt his hallways. Eleanor Ainsworth was not a ghost, but she had mastered the art of invisibility. It was a necessary skill in a world that valued dazzling wit and sparkling beauty, neither of which she possessed. She had a different kind of currency. She had intelligence, a quiet, methodical, and vastly underestimated intelligence. Her father, Sir Gideon, saw her as a commodity, a well-educated, well-behaved daughter, whose dowry, painstakingly accumulated by her grandfather, was her only true asset. He saw her silence as docility, her preference for books over balls as a sign of a retiring, uncomplicated nature. He was a simple man who saw a simple daughter. He was wrong. Eleanor's grandfather, the man who had built the fortune from nothing, had seen her differently. He had recognized the sharp, analytical mind behind her quiet eyes. He had taught her ledgers before needlepoint. He had explained compound interest and land yields, the subtle art of negotiation, the crucial difference between assets and cash flow. The world, he had told her, his voice rough with the accent he never lost, is a series of transactions, Ellie. Know the terms. Always know the terms. When the Duke of Alistair's proposal arrived, she was the one who sat with her grandfather's solicitor, Mr. Hemlock, and examined the ducal accounts. She saw the truth hidden in the columns of figures, the desperate state of the estate, the crushing weight of the mortgages, the sheer folly of the late Duke's expenditures. She saw the risk. She also saw the potential. The land was good. The name was ancient. It was a magnificent ship, badly captained and taking on water. "He is drowning, Miss Ainsworth," Mr. Hemlock had said, his face grim. "Yes," Eleanor had replied, her finger tracing the line item for a particularly ruinous mortgage held by a notorious lender. "But the vessel is sound." She understood the transaction perfectly. She was not being married. She was being acquired. Her fortune was bailing out his title. In return, she would be a duchess. Her father was ecstatic. Her future husband, she suspected, was merely resigned. She accepted the terms because they were the best she was likely to be offered. She was 24, past the first blush of youth, and possessed of a mind that made most eligible men uncomfortable. A remote, preoccupied duke who needed her money more than her conversation seemed a manageable sort of husband. She would be a quiet partner. She would be useful. She would find her place. Their first meeting after the betrothal was confirmed took place in the Duke's London library. He was taller than she remembered, with a severe, handsome face and eyes the color of a winter sky. He was impeccably polite. It was the sterile politeness one reserves for a necessary but uninteresting appointment. "Miss Ainsworth," he began, gesturing to a chair she did not take. She preferred to stand, to meet him on an even footing, even if he towered over her. "I feel it is my duty to be transparent about the situation you are marrying into." He proceeded to explain his financial predicament in the most condescendingly simple terms imaginable, as if he were speaking to a child. He spoke of unfortunate expenses and inherited obligations. He used metaphors involving leaky roofs and empty larders. Eleanor listened patiently, her hands clasped before her. She let the silence settle after he had finished his patronizing little speech. "Thank you, Your Grace," she said, her voice soft but clear. "I am aware of the specifics. I reviewed the accounts with Mr. Hemlock." Alistair blinked. "You reviewed them?" "Yes. The mortgages taken against the Northwood holdings seem the most pressing, particularly the one held by Messer Blackwood. His interest rate is punitive. Was refinancing not an option?" He stared at her. It was the first time he had truly looked at her, his gaze sharp with surprise. He saw that her eyes were not a simple brown, but a complex hazel, flecked with green and gold. He saw the intelligence held in their depths. It was disconcerting. "The collateral required was too high," he said stiffly. "My father leveraged everything of liquid value." "Not everything," she countered quietly. "The timber rights on the western parcels were not included. An oversight, perhaps. They could be worth a great deal if managed correctly. And the tenant farms in the southern valley, the yields have been underperforming for a decade. Are the leases fair? Is the soil being properly managed?" A muscle tightened in his jaw. This was not the conversation he had expected. He had anticipated shy compliance, perhaps a few nervous questions about the number of guest rooms or the color of the drawing room curtains. Instead, He was being questioned on estate management by a woman who should be contemplating her wedding trousseau. "The estate is my concern, Miss Ainsworth," he said, his tone clipped and final. It was a dismissal. "It will be my home," she replied, her gaze unwavering. "Its health will be my concern as well." He felt a surge of irritation. He had wanted a silent partner, a decorative, unobtrusive duchess who would produce an heir and leave the important matters to him. He had not bargained for an auditor in a bonnet. He put her unexpected acuity down to coaching from her solicitor, a parlor trick to make her seem less of a merchant's granddaughter. He had miscalculated, but he did not yet know the scale of his error. The wedding was a formal, muted affair. The Duke and his new Duchess removed to his primary seat, Blackwood Manor, a sprawling Gothic masterpiece that was as beautiful as it was financially draining. Eleanor found herself in a house that was a perfect metaphor for her marriage, magnificent on the surface, decaying from within. She did not occupy herself with needlepoint. In the first weeks, she moved through the house like a whisper. She spoke with the housekeeper, Mrs. Gable, a woman whose loyalty to the estate was as old and unyielding as the oak trees in the park. She learned of the waste, the inefficiencies, the staff who were loyal but lacked direction. She spent her mornings in the cavernous kitchens, not giving orders, but listening. She learned of the gardens, which could supply the house entirely if properly tended. She learned of the local merchants who overcharged the ducal household because no one ever checked the receipts. She did not speak of these things to her husband. He was a remote presence, consumed by his papers, his correspondence, his monumental task of saving their world. They dined together each evening, exchanging pleasantries that were as hollow and polished as the silver on the table. He would ask if she was comfortable. She would reply that she was. He would speak of the weather. She would agree that it was, indeed, going to rain. He was present, and he was absent. He was there, and he was not there. He saw a wife sitting at his table. He did not see the woman. She found her place in the household library. It was a dusty, neglected space, but the collection was magnificent. She began the quiet, methodical process of cataloging it. It was a task that suited her. It was orderly. It made sense. It was a way of imposing structure on a world that felt profoundly unstructured. It was during this task, a month into her marriage, that she sought a particular book on historical land charters. The Duke's private study was attached to the library, and she knew the book was likely there. He was out riding, inspecting some distant tenant farm. She let herself into the room. It was the heart of his world, a space of masculine clutter. Maps, ledgers, half-empty glasses of brandy, the faint scent of leather and cigar smoke. His desk was a chaotic landscape of paper. A letter, recently sealed but not yet sent, lay near the inkwell. It was addressed to Lord Vance. Curiosity was not a trait Eleanor typically indulged, but something about the crisp fold of the paper, the aggressive slash of the handwriting, drew her eye. She hesitated for only a moment. This was the man who owned her future. She had a right to know the terms of his thoughts. Her fingers, deft and silent, broke the wax seal. She unfolded the single sheet. Her eyes scanned the lines of text, her expression unchanging. She read of the loan, now unnecessary. She read of the London season. And then she came to the final paragraph. The assessment of her. The Ainsworth girl will do. She is plain and quiet, and understands nothing of business, which is a mercy. The dowry is all that matters. It will plug the holes in the ship, and she can occupy herself with needlepoint while I write the course. The words did not strike her like a blow. They landed with the cold, quiet finality of a stone dropping into a deep well. There was no splash, only a profound and sudden depth of silence. It was not a surprise. It was a confirmation. It was the precise, unvarnished truth of her position. He had not married a woman. He had purchased a solution. He had not gained a partner. He had acquired an asset whose primary virtue was its silence and its ignorance. A mercy. Her understanding would have been an inconvenience. She felt a strange, cold calm settle over her. There was no anger. Anger was a hot, useless emotion. There was only clarity. The kind of absolute, piercing clarity that comes after a long fever. She saw him. She saw the transaction. She saw her role in it with perfect, painful precision. She did not tear the letter. She did not throw it in the fire. With hands that were perfectly steady, she refolded it along its original creases. Then, with meticulous care, she made a new crease, sharp and exact, down the center, a subtle mark of its reading that only one who knew the paper intimately would ever notice. She heated the signet ring over the candle flame and dropped a perfect seal of red wax onto the back, pressing the ducal crest into it. She placed the letter back exactly where she had found it. She found the book on land charters and left the study, closing the door softly behind her. A door had closed inside her as well. It was a quiet click, almost inaudible, but it was locked, and she was the only one with the key. The change was not immediate. It was a gradual subtraction, a slow draining of color from the canvas of their shared life, so subtle that Alistair did not notice it at first. He was a man who noticed cracking foundations and rotting timbers, not the fading of a watercolor. His wife was still present at dinner. She still answered his questions about her day, but the answers became more concise. Her inquiries into his own affairs, which had been tentative but intelligent, ceased entirely. The space between them at the long dining table, already a chasm, grew cold and vast. He was too consumed by the Herculean task of his finances to pay it much mind. He was negotiating with creditors, reviewing accounts, trying to wring profit from mismanaged land. He worked late into the night, fueled by brandy and a desperate, aristocratic pride. He was the Duke. He would not fail. But slowly, things began to intrude upon his notice. He realized, one Tuesday evening, that he had not heard the sound of the pianoforte in weeks. Eleanor was a gifted musician, and the soft notes of Mozart or Haydn had often been a soothing backdrop to his evening work. The house was now silent, save for the ticking of the grandfather clock in the hall. A profound, unsettling silence. He noticed that the small vases of flowers that had begun to appear on mantelpieces and side tables were gone. He had not consciously registered their arrival, but he felt their absence. They had been a quiet touch of life in the somber, masculine rooms. Now the rooms were just somber again. He noticed his wife was no longer in the main library. The cataloging project, which she had described to him with a quiet enthusiasm he had found vaguely quaint, was apparently abandoned. The books and slips of paper were gone. He found her instead in a small, unused sitting room at the back of the house, reading novels. Not histories, not books on agriculture. Novels, frivolous things. He felt an unreasonable spike of annoyance. She was retreating into fiction while he wrestled with the grim reality of their existence. She was present, but she was absent. The household, which had started to run with a new, quiet efficiency under her unseen hand, began to slip. An old complacency returned. Meals were late. The waste from the kitchens increased. Mrs. Gable, the housekeeper, seemed perpetually flustered. "Is there a problem, Mrs. Gable?" he asked one afternoon, after a particularly egregious error with the delivery of wine. The housekeeper hesitated, twisting her hands in her apron. "It is difficult, Your Grace. The Duchess, she no longer advises." "Advises?" "She saw things, Your Grace, ways to be prudent. She spoke with the suppliers herself. She reviewed the accounts. Now, she says it is not her place. She says all household matters should be directed to you." Alistair frowned. He had no time to concern himself with the price of carrots or the ordering of beeswax. That was a wife's domain. Why was she suddenly abdicating her duties? It was another irritation, another small, inexplicable failure in the machinery of his life. He saw her less and less. She took her breakfast in her rooms. She spent her days walking in the gardens or reading in her secluded chamber. She was a polite, distant stranger who shared his roof and his name. He told himself it was for the best. He had wanted a quiet duchess. He now had one. The silence he had craved now felt unnervingly like a vacuum. The true catalyst arrived in the form of Mr. Finch, his estate manager. Finch was a man of the earth, his face a roadmap of worry lines carved by decades of unpredictable weather and fluctuating crop prices. He came to Alistair's study one morning, his hat clutched in his hands, his expression dire. "Your Grace," he began, his voice low, "there has been a development, a significant one." Alistair braced himself for more bad news, a failed crop, a tenant revolt. "The Blackwood mortgage," Finch said, his eyes wide. "It has been purchased." Alistair sat bolt upright. The Blackwood mortgage was the albatross around his neck. It was the largest, most predatory of his debts, held by a man who would delight in seeing the Duke of Alistair ruined. Purchased? By whom? Has Blackwood sold it to an even greater vulture? That is the strange part, Your Grace. It was purchased by a holding company, anonymous, acting through a London solicitor. They bought the debt in its entirety, paid in full. Alistair was stunned into silence. This made no sense. Who would do such a thing? Who would buy such a risky, toxic debt? An ally? He had few of those. An enemy, hoping to gain a final, fatal leverage over him? That seemed more likely. Vance, perhaps. No, Vance lacked the capital for such a move. "And there is more," Finch continued, his voice hushed with a kind of awe. "Whoever they are, they knew exactly which debt to acquire. It was the keystone, Your Grace, the one that gave us the least flexibility, the one Blackwood could have used to foreclose on the Northwood lands at a moment's notice. To target that specific debt, it requires an intimate knowledge of our finances. A knowledge, forgive me, that I thought only you and I possessed. An intimate knowledge of our finances." The words echoed in the silent study. Alistair's mind began to work, racing back through the past few months, gathering the disconnected clues that had been floating at the edge of his perception. He thought about the silence of the pianoforte. He thought about the absence of flowers. He thought about his wife's sudden, inexplicable withdrawal. He thought about her meetings with her own solicitor, Mr. Hemlock, which his valet had mentioned in passing. "The Duchess seems very occupied with her personal accounts, Your Grace." He had dismissed it as her managing her pin money. Pin money. The irony was acidic. He thought about their first meeting in the London library, her sharp, precise questions. The mortgages taken against the Northwood holdings seemed the most pressing, particularly the one held by Messer Blackwood. She had seen it from the very beginning. She had seen the keystone, and then, with a jolt that was both physical and profound, he thought of the letter to Vance left on his desk. She understands nothing of business. He rose from his chair, his movements stiff, mechanical. He went to the small escritoire where he kept his correspondence. He found the box containing Vance's replies. Tucked at the back was the draft of his own letter, the one he had kept for his records. He pulled it out. He had sealed it before sending the copy, but he had not folded this one. He remembered it being flat. It was not flat now. There was a single, sharp crease running down the center. A crease that had not been made by his own hand. It was a mark of violation, a quiet testament. It had been opened. It had been read. It had been folded and put away by someone with cold, precise fingers. The pieces fell into place, not like a gentle puzzle, but like the shattering of a great pane of glass. The world he thought he knew, the wife he thought he had, it all fractured in an instant. It was her. She was the anonymous investor. She had used her own money, the very dowry that was meant to be his salvation, to purchase his debt. She had not plugged the holes in his ship. She had bought the rudder. She had become his creditor, his silent, observant, and utterly underestimated creditor. He sank back into his chair, the letter clutched in his hand, the full, crushing weight of his arrogance, his blindness, his monumental folly descended upon him. He had married a woman of formidable intelligence and treated her like a decorative fool. He had written her off as a simpleton, and she had quietly executed a financial maneuver of breathtaking subtlety and power. The silence in the house was no longer a vacuum. It was a judgment. He knew, with a certainty that chilled him to the bone, that he had to find her. He had to face the woman he had so grievously misjudged. This was not a matter for solicitors or letters. This required a reckoning. He did not know where to look. She had become a phantom in her own home. He did not check the drawing room or the gardens. Instinct, a new and unfamiliar guide, led him down a dusty corridor on the ground floor, a wing of the house long neglected. He found her in the old estate office, a room he had not entered in years. The air was thick with the scent of old paper and beeswax. Sunlight streamed through a grimy window, illuminating dust motes dancing in the air. And there she was. Eleanor. Not the Duchess in silks and lace, but a woman at work. She sat at a vast oak table, surrounded by ledgers and survey maps. Her hair was loosely pinned up, a smudge of ink on her cheek. She was not reading a novel. She was studying the accounts of his estate, the very heart of his world. She looked up as he entered, her expression unreadable. It was not angry, not triumphant, not hurt. It was the calm, neutral face of a banker appraising a client. In that moment, he saw her for the first time. He saw the strength in her posture, the clarity in her hazel eyes, the formidable mind working behind that quiet facade. He saw the woman he had dismissed. He walked slowly toward the table, the damning letter held in his hand. He did not speak. He simply laid it on the polished wood between them, on top of a ledger detailing the timber yields of the western parcels. Her eyes flickered down to it, then back up to his face. She said nothing. She waited. The silence stretched, thick and heavy. He had rehearsed a dozen speeches on his way to this room. Accusations, demands, questions. They all crumbled to dust in the face of her profound stillness. The only words that remained were the truth. "I was wrong," he said. The admission was quiet, but it filled the cavernous room. It was the hardest sentence he had ever uttered. He took a breath, the air tasting of dust and regret. "I was a fool, an arrogant, blind fool. I wrote that. that damnable letter because my pride was wounded, because I was ashamed of needing your fortune, of my father's failures, and so I belittled you. I dismissed you. I created a fiction of a simple-minded wife to soothe my own vanity. He looked at her, truly looked, searching her face for any reaction. There was only a flicker of something in her eyes, too quick to name. I thought I was making a transaction, he continued, his voice raw. I see now that you were the one who understood the terms from the very beginning. I saw a dowry. You saw a failing business. I saw a quiet wife. You saw a negligent partner. You saw the truth of my situation when I refused to see the truth of you. He gestured to the ledgers spread across the table. This, all of this, you have done the work I should have been doing. You have learned my estate, my history, my failures, while I learned nothing of the woman I married. He paused, the weight of his confession settling upon him. He had not come to ask for forgiveness. He did not deserve it. He had come to acknowledge the truth, to cede the victory. The debt, he said, his voice dropping. You hold it now. You are my creditor. It was not a question. It was a statement of fact. For the first time, Eleanor spoke. Her voice was as calm and clear as it had been in the London library. Yes. One word. It held the power of a thousand. It confirmed everything. What do you intend to do? He asked. She looked at him, and for the first time, he saw not a banker, but a glimmer of the woman beneath. He saw a flicker of old hurt, quickly suppressed. That, Your Grace, she said, her tone meticulously formal, is a matter of business, and as you so correctly surmised, I understand nothing of it. The irony was a razor's edge. It cut him cleanly, deeply. He had no defense against it. He deserved it. He had expected a confrontation, a storm of tears and recriminations. He was prepared for that. He was not prepared for this. This cool, surgical precision. This absolute control. She had taken his greatest insult and forged it into an impenetrable shield. He took a step back from the table, feeling as though the ground had vanished from beneath his feet. He had entered the room a duke, the master of his home. He now stood there as a supplicant, a debtor before the woman who held the fate of his legacy in her capable hands. He had sought to right the course of his ship, only to find that she was now the captain. Before he could speak again, she picked up a pen, dipped it in ink, and made a small notation in one of the ledgers. It was a gesture of dismissal. The audience was over. He left the room, closing the door behind him. He walked back down the dusty corridor, the echo of that single, quiet yes ringing in his ears. He had not been defeated in a duel or at a negotiating table. He had been defeated in a silent room by a quiet woman he had never bothered to see. The reckoning had occurred, and he had been found wanting. The question now, the one that terrified him more than any creditor's demand, was what came next. The days that followed were a new kind of hell. The house remained silent, but now Alistair was acutely aware of the reason. It was not emptiness. It was a deliberate, controlled withholding. Eleanor maintained her cool, distant politeness. They still dined together, but the pretense of pleasantry was gone. Their conversations were brief, functional, and devoid of any warmth. She was a ghost of his own making, haunting him with her competence. He found evidence of her work everywhere. A revised budget for the kitchens left on the housekeeper's desk. A letter to a timber merchant inquiring about new, higher prices. A detailed plan for crop rotation on the southern farms. She was running his estate, and she was doing it better than he ever had. She did not ask his permission. She did not seek his approval. She simply acted. He felt adrift in his own home. His authority had evaporated. He was the Duke in name only. The true power resided in that dusty estate office, behind a closed door. He also learned, through a venomous letter from his cousin, the extent of Lord Vance's treachery. Vance had not been trying to help him with a loan. He had been gathering information, spreading rumors of Alistair's imminent collapse, hoping to buy the ducal lands for a pittance when the foreclosure came. Vance's fury at the news of the paid mortgage was palpable even on paper. He accused Alistair of hiding assets, of dealing with him in bad faith. Reading the letter, Alistair felt a cold rage, but it was tempered by a new, humbling perspective. Vance was a predator, but Alistair had been a fool. He had trusted the wrong person and dismissed the one person who had been his truest ally, even when he had given her every reason to be his enemy. He knew he had to act, not just for his pride, but as a first fumbling step toward atonement. He could not undo his words to Eleanor, but he could control his actions now. He rode to London. He did not seek out Vance at his club for a public confrontation. That was the old Alistair's way. The new Alistair, the one being forged in the crucible of his wife's silence, chose a different weapon. He went to his solicitor, armed with the meticulous notes Eleanor had made, for she had investigated Vance's financial dealings as a potential threat to the estate. Alistair dismantled his cousin's position with brutal precision. He exposed Vance's own debts, his precarious investments, the very house of cards Vance had tried to keep hidden. He did not ruin him. He simply contained him. He sent a letter to Vance detailing exactly how vulnerable he was and suggested, in no uncertain terms, that he would be wise to retire to his country estate and trouble London no further. It was a quiet, clinical execution. It was Eleanor's way. When he returned to Blackwood Manor, he did not know if she was even aware of what he had done. He sought her out, back in the estate office. She was there, as always, a general in her command post. "I have dealt with Vance," he said, standing in the doorway. She looked up, her expression unchanging. "How so?" "I used your research. I made it clear that it would be in his best interest to cease his activities." A flicker of something, surprise, crossed her face. "You did not call him out?" "A duel would have been for my honor," he said. "This was for the security of the estate, for our security." He stressed the word "our." It felt foreign on his tongue. "It was a business decision." She held his gaze for a long moment. Then she gave a single, almost imperceptible nod. It was not praise. It was not forgiveness. It was an acknowledgement, a recognition that he had, for the first time, used his power with intelligence rather than arrogance. It was a start. He began to spend time in the estate office. He did not sit at the main table. He took a small desk in the corner. He did not give orders. He watched. He read. He learned. He saw the sheer volume of work she had undertaken, the complexity of the problems she was solving. He began to ask questions, not as a duke demanding answers, but as a student. "Why did you choose to renegotiate the lease with the miller first?" "Because his is the only mill on the river for 10 miles, she would reply without looking up. "Control of the mill gives us leverage over the grain prices for the entire region." Slowly, tentatively, a new dynamic began to form. Their conversations were still focused on business, on the estate, but they were conversations between equals. He began to see the workings of her mind, the elegant logic, the sharp, intuitive leaps. He saw the dry wit that occasionally surfaced in a marginal note on a ledger, a wry comment on a foolish expense made by his father. He started noticing other things, too. the way she chewed on the end of her pen when she was deep in thought, the small, satisfied smile that touched her lips when a column of figures finally balanced. The intelligence in her eyes was no longer disconcerting. It was captivating. He found himself looking for it, seeking it out. One evening, he brought a tray with 2 cups of tea into the office. She was working late, as she often did. She looked up in surprise as he set a cup down beside her. "Thank you," she said, her voice softer than he had heard it in months. He sat at his own desk, sipping his tea. The silence between them was different now. It was not a void. It was a shared space, filled with the quiet rustle of paper and the scratching of pens. It was companionable. He realized, with a sense of shock, that he was happy. Here, in this dusty room, working alongside this remarkable woman, he felt a sense of purpose and contentment that had been absent from his life for as long as he could remember. He was not just saving his legacy. He was building something new. With her. The turning point came a month later. They had been working together on a plan to invest in new drainage systems for the low-lying fields, a significant but necessary expense. The debate had been lively, a true partnership of his historical knowledge of the land and her sharp financial acumen. As she was gathering her papers for the night, he finally found the courage to say what had been on his mind for weeks. "Eleanor," he began, using her given name for the first time since their wedding vows. She froze, her back to him. "This arrangement," he said, his voice quiet but firm. "It is not sustainable, not for me." She turned slowly, her face guarded. "The estate is recovering. The plan is working." "I am not speaking of the estate," he said, taking a step toward her. "I am speaking of us, of this armed truce we are living in. You are my creditor. You are my partner in business, but you are also my wife." "A wife who understands nothing of business," she retorted, the words a shield she still held between them. The hurt was there, raw and fresh. "A wife who understands everything that matters," he corrected her gently. "A wife I was too blind and stupid to see. I do not want a creditor, Eleanor. I do not want a business manager. I want a partner in all things." He stopped before her, close enough to see the flecks of gold in her hazel eyes. "You once said you would be my partner or my banker. You said I could not have a silent wife and a silent investor both. I am asking you to make a new choice, or rather, to allow me to make one." "What choice?" she whispered. "Choose to be my partner, my true partner, and I will spend the rest of my life proving I am worthy of the title of your husband." He reached out, not to touch her, but holding his hand open in the space between them. A plea, an offering. "The debt is an obstacle. It is a symbol of my failure. Let me repay it. Not to the anonymous holding company, but to you. Let us tear up the papers and begin again." She looked from his face to his outstretched hand. He saw the conflict in her eyes, the war between her justified caution and a flicker of something he desperately hoped was a willingness to trust again. "The world is a series of transactions," she said, her voice barely audible. "My grandfather taught me that." "Then let us make a new one," he urged. "Your trust for my devotion, your wisdom for my strength, your forgiveness for my repentance, a marriage, a true one, those are my terms." She looked at him for a long, heart-stopping moment. Then, slowly, she raised her hand and placed it in his. Her touch was light, tentative, but it was there. It was acceptance. A year passed. It was a year of quiet, steady rebuilding. Not of finances, for those were well on their way to recovery, but of a marriage. Trust, once shattered, was a delicate thing to reconstruct. It was built not on grand gestures, but on 1,000 small moments of attention and respect. Alistair learned to listen. He learned to see. He learned the woman he had married. He discovered her love for ridiculously sentimental novels, her surprising skill at chess, her deep and abiding affection for the stray cat that had taken up residence in the stables. He learned that her quietness was not a lack of opinion, but a careful consideration of a world that seldom listened to women. She, in turn, learned to let him in. She slowly lowered the shield she had held for so long. She shared her thoughts, not just on ledgers, but on books and music and the future. She let him see her vulnerability as well as her strength. The silence in the house was replaced by conversation, by laughter, by the sound of the pianoforte playing once more in the evenings. Section the estate office was still their domain, but it was no longer a command center and a penitent cell. It was a shared space, their table now one large desk where they worked side by side. Their partnership flourished, their complementary skills making the estate more prosperous than it had been in a century. One crisp autumn afternoon, Alistair found her not in the office, but in the newly restored glass houses, a project she had championed and funded. She was standing in the warm, humid air, her hand resting on her gently swelling abdomen, looking at a rare orchid that had just come into bloom. He came up behind her and wrapped his arms around her, resting his chin on her shoulder. She leaned back against him, a gesture of easy, familiar affection that would have been unthinkable a year ago. "It is beautiful," she said, her eyes on the exotic flower. "Not as beautiful as its patron," he murmured into her hair. She smiled, a genuine, unguarded smile that still had the power to take his breath away. "Flattery, Your Grace? Is that in the budget?" "It is an unlisted asset, my love, and my supply is infinite." He looked around the glasshouse at the tangible proof of their joint efforts. The estate was thriving. Their home was filled with warmth and life. They were expecting their first child, an heir who would inherit not a name saddled with debt, but a legacy of true partnership. Later that evening, he watched her by the fire in the library. She was reading, a familiar sight, but her feet were propped up on a stool he had fetched for her, and a soft shawl was wrapped around her shoulders. He looked at her, this quiet, brilliant woman who had saved him from himself. He thought of the arrogant, desperate man who had written that dismissive letter and barely recognized him. That man had thought the dowry was all that mattered. He knew now that her fortune had been the least of her gifts. Her true value was in her mind, her resilience, her quiet strength. Her greatest gift had been the chance to see the world and himself through her clear, intelligent eyes. He had started with a transaction and had, by some miracle of grace he felt he had not earned, ended with love. He had thought he needed to right the course of his ship. He had been wrong. He had needed to learn to sail alongside a far better captain, and for that, he would be eternally grateful. If you made it to the end, thank you for listening. The Duke made a terrible first impression based on arrogance and pride. Tell me in the comments, if you were in Eleanor's position and had to set terms for a new beginning, what one condition would you have added to the arrangement? I cannot wait to read your answers. In our next story, a reclusive botanist, scarred by a tragic fire, inherits a title he never wanted and a ward he does not know how to raise. He hires a governess with a mysterious past of her own, a woman who sees the man behind the scars and is determined to bring both him and the neglected gardens of his estate back to life. But the secrets that drove them into hiding are not as buried as they seem. Thank you for being here. Please consider liking this story and subscribing to the channel for more tales of love, loss, and the slow, steady work of healing a wounded heart. They arrive here, in this quiet place, whenever they are ready.